And our first business in the information meeting will be to invite the Department of Geology and Minerals up to give us some information, and we'll go from there. And it's great to see both of you.
All our news is good news.
That's also good.
That's really good. Good afternoon, everyone, and thanks for inviting us. For the record, my name is Vicki McConnell, and I'm the director for the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. And I have with me today...
I've done this enough. I should have remembered how to do it. My name is Gary Lynch. I'm the assistant director of Doug Amy.
Thank you.
And mainly with the Mine Land Reclamation and Regulation Program.
I passed out a couple of pages of testimony, and really what we want to do today is just take the opportunity to share a couple of programs and issues that we see that are coming up this legislative session that affect either the state or the geologic or geosciences aspect of the state. And we appreciate the time that you'll take to listen to these, and we are open for questions at any time, so please don't hesitate to interrupt, and I'll make Gary answer them. Just as a quick reminder, we're a relatively small agency. We really have two programs, and I put an organizational chart as the second page of your of the testimony. Two programs are, the first one is our Geologic Survey and Sciences that serves as the State Department of Geology for the state. We gather geoscientific information, share that with other agencies, with local governances, with our the citizens of the state. We try to be on top of those issues that might have relevance, that would have geoscientific background in it, mapping groundwater issues, geological hazards, a whole variety of issues that we usually get involved in. We also have a program, our Mineral Land Regulation and Reclamation Program, and many of you are familiar with that. It is primarily the program that regulates the operation and reclamation for surface mining, and in this state that is mostly, not completely, but mostly has to do with aggregate, sand and gravel, and then upland crushed rock. And so we're responsible for making sure they're operated in a manner that doesn't cause off-site impact, and then there's a reclamation plan that's implemented for a beneficial secondary use of whatever that of the use or spent area. If you look at the first page again, there's just a couple things to bring forward. Within the governor's recommended budget, we have brought forth a relatively aggressive policy option package, suggesting and recommending to the state that the state would be well positioned to go forward and collect LIDAR, which is a type of very, very accurate topographical data on a statewide basis. Right now, these LIDAR data are being collected primarily through cities and governments and some private industry. We use it. Almost every natural resource agency would find a use for this information. Really, any agency, any public or private industry that uses very accurate, when we say topographical information, that means what are the very accurate elevations on the surface of the earth and what are the landforms on the surface of the earth would find use for this type of data. One example would be stream profiles. You can get very accurate stream profiles from these data. You don't have to go out and measure. You can, because the data are collected in such a way that you have database, official database information. Stream profiles, with the folks we've spoken with, that would be very useful for environmental, would be very useful for forestry, it's very useful for ecosystem and stream restorations. We use it primarily for looking at geohazards, for identifying landslides and debris flow areas that you can't really see through. The interesting part of these data is that it can collect the bare earth data through the vegetation. And I bet you folks have noticed there's a bit of vegetation on the west side of the state. And so it makes it difficult to collect very accurate elevation data. We're asking for $4.5 million to collect about 10,000 square miles of LIDAR data. That would become publicly accessible, of course, and would be used by all of the natural resource agencies, again, state and local governments, and we're looking to partner with as many private industries as we can. Right now in the governor's recommended budget, this program, this policy package is listed for $4.3 million as a certificate of participation, which means essentially you're taking a loan out and paying it back over the next five biennia. There is not, at this point, any benefit, or there isn't anything given in this particular package for any of the staffing to administer it. So we're still working on some of the particulars on this one.
Would this include the 3 mile coast underwater region in that mapping as well?
Chair Roblin and committee members, the LIDAR data are only good to the surface of the water. It does not really collect through the water. You need bathymetric data for the 3 mile limit, and that is another package that I know is being floated right now, and would be extremely beneficial. And I fully support the discussion and dialogue on the bathymetric data. But that's collected in a completely different manner. Thank you for asking, though. And actually, that brings me into a second. We didn't do this on purpose. I planned, but that brings me to the second bullet I have here, which is the tsunami hazard mitigation. We have had a recommendation from the Joint Interim Committee on Emergency Preparedness to accelerate our tsunami inundation mapping part of our tsunami hazard mitigation program. Presently, we are looking at completing what we term as postage stamps along the state, which would be the major communities along the state, by 2018. We only receive federal funding through NOAA and the National Tsunami Hazard Mitigation Program right now. That's a competitive funding program. Complete as many of the maps as we can within the other things we have to use that program money for. We are completely in agreement that it is a little bit negligent on us and the state of not trying to complete all of those inundation maps as soon as possible. So we have a conversation, a dialogue now for accelerating that program and completing the entire state by 2011. So that would be two biennia. We would not just do the postage stamp. We would not just do the communities. We would do the entire state. And the benefit to that is then all of these folks that are in parks or along beaches that are visiting would also have the benefit of knowing what the where the tsunami, where the inundation hazard is as well.
Another question along that line. In order to really know how that tsunami is going to act, you really need to know the floor of the ocean. So that mapping for the ocean floor would be reasonably, I would suspect, essential to really understand where that wave is going to go.
Chair Roblin and committee members, that's exactly correct. And our tsunami package that we have together, the first biennia is primarily collecting those data, the bathymetric data and the LIDAR data along the coast. The second biennia, and then the second part would be doing some what we say paleo tsunami mapping, which is rectifying the modeling that you do with actually going out and mapping where you can find remnants from past tsunamis. The second biennia would be turning all of that bathymetric, that LIDAR data, the models into the inundation maps then. So that is a very astute question on your part. The third thing I wanted to speak about in relation to geohazards and programs that we have out right now is that we are due to release the statewide seismic needs hazard assessment report, which was Senate Bill 2 in 2005. That report will be out before the end of this legislative session. In that seismic needs assessment, we were asked to look at the seismic vulnerability of all public schools in the state. That's kindergarten through higher ed. We were actually looked at through community colleges. And all the emergency response facilities, all fire stations, all police stations, and all acute care hospitals. What we have done are conduct the evaluations of those buildings through rapid visual screening. We're combining that with geologic and soil information that will be compiled into a GIS, so a spatial database that will be released that'll name, as we call it, the good, the bad, and the ugly buildings in the state, the public buildings in the state. The idea with this particular program was to go forward then with a seismic needs granting program that would allow organizations or entities that own or are responsible for these buildings to be able to apply for seismic rehabilitation grants and fund money. That has not been implemented yet. So we are a little concerned when we do release these information that we're not sure how to explain to the public how this next step, the next step with the ability to be able to fix those buildings are going to go forward. We'll be sharing that information with the legislature as soon as the report in the is completed.
Mr. Chair, quick
yes.
question.
Yes.
Rapid visual survey, is that the term you used a minute ago?
Yes, Representative Meyer.
Is that looking at?
Well, it's a little more than looking at and a little less than a structural report. I'll say it's a little more than looking at and a lot less than a structural report.
Okay.
What it is, it's through a FEMA rapid visual screening 154. It's a technique that they have developed and that we follow to the T on how you do this.
Okay.
So you do go out, you do look at the building, but then you look at the plans. There's several other things that you take into consideration before you rate the building.
Okay. Thank you.
To follow up, we do have two legislative concepts, two bills that are out right now. The first one is Senate Bill 149, which would be a bill that deals with strengthening our aggregate resource extraction and protection enforcement capabilities. We have modest enforcement capabilities, and frequently when we do have the few times that we have to have a compliance issue, it frequently takes us quite a long time and quite a bit of money to be able to remedy the problem or the issue. And so we are looking at strengthening those enforcement capabilities in a way that is fair to all the operators, because the fees that we end up paying, the expense that is put out there for enforcement, comes from our fees, and so it's being paid by the entire bulk of the operators, and to be fair to the folks that we're working with for compliance issues. Part and parcel with that is the entire discussion right now about aggregate resources in the state and where they are located and their need for aggregate resources. And we do urge the state to think about developing a statewide policy on aggregate resources and aggregate issues in the state. And we'd be happy to be involved in that dialogue at any time. The second right now is a legislative concept and will be introduced as a bill soon through Representative Hunt's office on behalf of the agency, is looking at our oil and gas drilling program that right now has seen a modest boom in activity, primarily based on the coal bed methane work that's occurring in the Coos Bay area. And again, we It's a fee-based program. When we see increases in the activity or demands on those fee-based programs, we frequently stress out the ability of being able to actually have staff to take care of what you need to do for good reclamation and for good operation. And so we're looking right now to bring the fee restructure back into line with the needs we have for staff, and also to I would think that there's a considerable, I'd like to say there's a considerable amount of housekeeping involved in this bill as well, since we had not reviewed the statutes for several years, several decades actually, and there's been quite a few changes in oil and gas since then. It's a very technical bill, involves spacing for wells whenever, you know, so it was time to really have a good look at that bill too. So we'd like to see that out there and have a chance for folks to have a look at it. And we'd be happy to entertain any further questions or comments. And Gary, if you wanted to add anything on either one of these.
I think that if there are questions, we'd be happy to answer them. I don't have a whole lot to add at this point.
I'll ask one on the coal bed methane. When that company started doing that and they first came in, I thought everybody worked very well together, and I assume that's still happening. They recognized that we hadn't really looked at those statutes for a long time. They have been doing this exploration in other places. I know that they put together a plan that made most of the people in our area feel pretty comfortable about what they were doing with the extracted water, all of those other kinds of stuff. Are we taking that in consideration as we build those new rules?
Chair Roblin and committee, they have been very good to work with. And they recognize, frankly, that their work was being subsidized by the aggregate industry because to their credit, they came to us and said, is there a way we can, you know, pull our ore in this boat? And frankly, we had to turn them down because we don't have general receipts authority to accept that kind of contribution. Maybe something we want to consider. But they have, and not only MEC, but Northwest Natural and Enerfin Resources as well have supported both the concept that Vicki talked about in changing the regulations and bringing them up. Frankly, our current statutes are out of date with the APA and the Administrative Procedures Act, so that needs to be fixed. But all of them support a fee increase, which is a reasonable fee increase, and so they've been very good to work with, particularly MEC.
And the other question I have has to do with aggregate. And from our perspective, again, on the South Coast, that's a real scarce commodity. And we're looking at a problem with respect to the Umpqua and federal restrictions and federal permits. Is there anything we can ask for help or guidance as we go through that issue with regard to aggregate?
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, I actually met with federal agencies this morning and with the governor's office, president, part of what's called the core team, and this issue is coming up. I think we need to get back to a position where everybody understands that we need healthy streams and rivers for salmon. We need to protect our agricultural land, and we need a long-term affordable supply of aggregate. And those things, trying to find the balance between those is going to take some time and effort, and we've seen some failed exercises like this in the past, and it's time to I think, find the energy to solve this dilemma. But as we see in the Southwest and the growth that's going on in the Southwest, and the demand for aggregate, it points out the one thing we do know, and that is as population expands, the demand for aggregate expands. And so we are looking down the road 20 years in Oregon, what that does to the population and what that will do for the demand for aggregate and the pressure it will put on healthy streams and farmland. It's time to start trying to solve that equation. And the federal agencies have a key role to play. And they're not the easiest sometimes to deal with on this. I've always characterized that their boss is 3,000 miles away. Our boss is a few miles away. So,
I see this dilemma of us importing aggregate from Canada or Mexico on barges to our port, and I find that a strange dilemma.
Chair Roblin and committee members, certainly you would think a state that's got as much basalt laying around in it would, you know, I'm thinking maybe of importing it from Eastern Oregon, which is almost as exotic as Mexico or Canada. But, you know, that really is part of the conversation, is to have a look at the economy and the economies of scale, but also have just a good look at where the resources are and what the costs are for things. Those issues, trucking it from one side of the state to the other, as opposed to barging it in from Canada, as opposed to looking at how you deal with it in a more local. The model always has been, of course, you want your resources as close as you can to where you need it because it's expensive. But it's fixable. We really do need to have the discussion.
I might add that one of the ramifications of this issue is that, and ODI will be the first to say this, is as you increase the transportation distance of aggregate, you drive the price up. As you drive the price up, ODOT builds less roads. And so that's a real concern for them.
Okay. I just wanted to follow up on a comprehensive aggregate resource policy. Is that what you're talking about? We need to begin that discussion. How would we begin that?
Pardon me. I have this frog.
Me too.
Representative Smith and Chair Roblin and committee members. And that's a good question. We've had some conversations within some of the natural resource agencies. There was actually an aggregate agriculture consensus group that met through, I think it began in 2005. And I think that was a good springboard. Unfortunately, at this point, it has terminated, but maybe there is enough of a structure there left to put together to start that dialogue again. And we certainly want to look at it from our point of view. We would like to actually look at developing an economic study and a resource study that is current and to date. For now, we have done those in the past, but they're dated now, and so it's really time to develop that information again. And we certainly think that's something that we could contribute to the whole conversation.
Thank you very much. I honestly think that's where we
have
to go.
Yeah. Okay,
yeah.
I appreciate that too.
Yeah. Other question I have is that, with regard to the mapping of the ocean floor, that 3 miles, I think it was at the last state land board meeting that they identified that they'd mapped about 5% of the ocean floor. And you're talking about the opportunity to do that in the next 2 bienniums. Is the $1.4 million in that budget deal enough to actually, that's a lot of ocean floor to map.
Chair Berblin and committee members, that's a good question. The $1.4 million that we have in the tsunami package for the data collection is specifically for the nearshore bathymetry. It would not be all the way out to the 3 miles of the territorial sea. We're being very selfish there and looking at what we needed, because the specific question we had is what would it take to complete these tsunami inundation maps in an accelerated time, and so that's what we very narrowly answered that question then.
Okay.
So in order to actually collect the bathymetric data that Professors Goldfinger and Wright were discussing with, Professor Wright was who gave the presentation for State Land Board, would be the full 3 miles, and would be a much larger enterprise. And I believe they have a price tag on that of around $4 or $5 million, you know, $4, $5, $6 million. It's just money, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, right. So.
It's all money.
I guess the other question I have is, are you having in the conversation regarding the wave parks and the attachment of different kinds of buoys to ocean floor?
Chair Roblin and committee members, we really are not involved in either regulation or follow-up on the wave energy discussion because we pretty much end right there where that wet sand is when it comes to the mapping, except for some of the inundation. However, we do sit on, as ex officio members, on OPAC, the Ocean Policy Advisory Council, and they do have a subcommittee for wave energy, and we do sit on that subcommittee because we find the whole process fascinating and are very interested in seeing how this technology is going to mature.
Any other questions?
Actually, I do.
Okay.
Question about the funding, the $4.5 million for the LIDAR, and do the feds get involved with this process? Are there other ways to look for funding sources? And also business interest in this, because I'm assuming that this has wide range of use, and if there's a way to cost share.
Right. Representative Maurer, and committee members and Chair Roblin. That's an excellent question, and I'm very glad you asked it. Presently, we are working on a LIDAR consortium because, frankly, we need the data now, and we have brought forward this concept of collecting the data across. And when we say statewide, we're primarily talking about the western side of the state, because that's where the trees are, that's where you need to get through to the bare earth information. We will be collecting this winter 2,100 square miles of LIDAR data that through this consortium of federal, state, and communities. It's primarily from Mount Hood, or from Hood River to the mouth to Astoria, and through all of the Portland metro area. So we have Metro, we have the city of Hood River, we have ODOT, we have U.S. Geological Survey, we have, I don't even know what the list looks like anymore, but we've managed that. We have managed to develop that consortia and leverage a very modest amount of general fund to collect this 2,100 square miles of data. So we really are looking at, when we asked for the $4.5 million to collect data on the west side of the state, we're looking at leveraging that as well to have a conversation with FEMA, with the U.S. Forest Service, with BLM, with all those big federal landowners, because we're not going to collect the data for them. That's not the area that we collect the data, where there's issues, where there are urban interfaces, or where there are issues with that. So we certainly think that we'll be able to leverage that to collect. We've also had conversations with Weyerhaeuser. They're very interested in LIDAR data, and we'll be collecting that in their forest areas regardless. Now, whether or not they'll make it publicly accessible is something we still have to continue those conversations. But they see the usefulness of these particular data anyway. And one thing to mention, as geologists, we're interested in getting rid of all the trees and looking at the bare earth. LIDAR actually collects what's called a cloud of data. So it collects the returns, this elevations from everything, from all the tops of trees, from the tops of buildings, and all the way to the bare earth. So the usefulness is not just in the bare earth information, but it's looking at canopies, it's looking at underbrush, it's looking at, depending on how you process and return the information. So we find that there'll be many partners that would be involved in leveraging this the information.
Can we quote you on that?
You certainly may.
Representative Dingfelder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize. I might have been out of the room when you had said this. And just my colleagues, I don't think, know this about me, but I actually have an undergraduate degree in geomorphology, and my husband's a geologist/environmental engineer. We don't talk about this stuff all the time, but so I'm of great interest to me. And one of the questions I had is, could this data, will it be available to local planning agencies? I know you talked about Metro, and, you know, I'm thinking about the, we all know about the development on the coast and how we can make sure that we don't have development issues that come up like that, where we had competing, my understand, competing geologists that said whether this was prone to landslides or not, and, you know, what the substrate, how stable that actually was. So could this information be used, for instance, in evaluating coastal development and making sure we don't have situations like we're in right now? I think it's the Capes. Is it still in court?
Yes.
Yeah, so I just want to find out if that information will be available to local and regional planning agencies as well.
Representative Dingfelder and committee members, absolutely. That's why we want to, that's why we're having the conversation of collecting this as a public, as a statewide public entity, because we think that it should be available for everyone to be able to access and to use. And we that is one of the primary interests of local governances that have, that are leveraging and that are partnering with us right now for this, the LIDAR data that we are collecting now is for their land use decision making. It's excellent for stormwater, for determining where you have stormwater runoff, where you don't. It really has a wide variety. So absolutely, it would be. Now, having said that, it is data. It will be interpreted.
Mm-hmm.
There's always the issue that you have one expert interpreting it different than another expert. I mean, there simply isn't a way to fix that other than to make sure that you have your professionals are ethical and are using the best state of the practice.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions?
I would mention that if you want more information just on the primer of what is LIDAR, you can go to our website, www.oregongeology.com, and look, we have just issued a one of our Cascadia magazines that is all about landslides and LIDAR, and it has a great primer on how these data are collected and how they're used and how they're processed.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. We appreciate the opportunity to come in and meet with everyone.
So I'll close that hearing and open another hearing on from the State Weed Board. I know that in our last conversation here about a couple of bills we're having, a number of issues came up where people had questions about how the weed board worked and invasive species and all these other issues. So just wanted to get a little bit more. We got to have you back.
For the record, my name is Dan Hilburn. I'm the administrator of the plant division for the Oregon Department of Agriculture. Would you like me to just answer questions, or would you like a two-minute overview of the State Weed Board, or how can I help?
I think a two-minute overview of the State Weed Board is important. Hopefully, a lot of people here do know about the Weed Board, but I think there are people who do not, and so a short one and then some questions about some of those issues, because I think, and the relation between the Weed Board and invasive species.
Yeah, exactly.
This other group that we just were talking about, you know, putting another member on, do they communicate? What's the avenues for those things to happen?
I'd be happy to do that. And they do communicate.
Okay.
For instance, I'm on both. I'm a State Weed Board member. I'm the Department of Agriculture's representative, and I'm also the department's representative on the Invasive Species Council. So there's fairly close cooperation there. The State Weed Board was set up in statute long before I started working for state government, so it's been around for a while. It's a seven-member board. It has two county commissioners, one from the east side and one from the west side. There's three farmers on it. There's a nursery person, and then I represent the Department of Agriculture on that board. Bill Hansel is the current chair of the commissioner in Umatilla County. The board has three primary functions. It advises the Noxious Weed Control Department or the Department of Agriculture. It maintains the state noxious weed list, and it distributes a major 66 grants for noxious weed control to all kinds of land management agencies, soil and water conservation districts, weed districts for noxious weed control work. A little bit about that list. The state noxious weed list is divided into three pieces. There's an A list, a B list, and a T list. The A list are the really bad ones. kudzu that Representative Dinkfelder mentioned last time is on that list. Patterson's curse is on that list. Purple star thistle. Things that we don't have and don't want are on that list. Or if we do have them, they're under eradication. We're trying to get rid of them. We're trying to contain them. The B list is for things that are already here and widespread, and Himalayan blackberry and Scotch broom are good examples of B-listed weeds. They're bad news, but they're here, and we could take all the general fund in the state and throw them at Scotch broom or Himalayan blackberry, and it wouldn't make much difference, or we'd turn our back and it'd be right back at us. So we focus on those A-listed weeds first to try to keep them from becoming B-listed weeds. The B-listed weeds get attention from the biological control aspect. Those are the weeds that we introduce biological control agents for. So the knapweeds and yellow star thistle and Scotch broom. There's two biological control agents that have been released on Scotch broom. So it's not that we don't work on them. It's just that we're not in an eradication mode for them. We're trying to suppress them as best we can through biological control agents. And the T list is the target list. That's what the state weed board wants the department to spend their time and effort on. It has some A weeds and some B weeds on it. In order to get on the list, let me go through that process. First of all, people all over the state recommend weeds for the state noxious weed list, and we put them on what we call a watch list. And as time allows, we go through that watch list and we do risk assessments. So staff are assigned to look into the literature. Where's the weed from? What does it do in other places where it's been introduced? What are the possible economic and ecological consequences were to become established? Once the risk assessment is done, that is presented to the state weed board, and the weed board makes a decision. Does it go on the list? A, B, or not at all? And every year there are two or three weeds that they consider for addition to the list. And then whatever gets on the list, the department considers that for addition to the state quarantine, which is an administrative rule which takes the state weed board's noxious weed list and turns it into a law which says you can't import it, grow it, sell it, that sort of thing. And the two lists are related, but they're not identical. For instance, St. John's wort is on the state noxious weed list, but it's not on the quarantine list. And the reason is a few people grow that as an herbal remedy or stomach issues, I think. And so that activity doesn't really impact the overall abundance of the weed. So it's on the state noxious weed list. It's something that we can encourage people to control. You can get a grant to control it if you can, if you submit one. But you can also grow it as a crop, and a few people do. So that's how state noxious weed list is connected to the quarantine list. Now, the Invasive Species Council is a different body. It's designed to coordinate not just weed issues, but marine, aquatic, terrestrial, invertebrate issues related to invasive species. So there are four agencies, and then the bill that we talked about last week would add a fifth agency to that, as well as eight at-large members from industry, universities, federal agencies, local governments, etc., on that group. So invasive species is a broad issue. Terrestrial weeds is a piece of that issue. The two groups do communicate. Actually, our next meeting is a joint meeting in February with the State Noxious Weed Board and the Invasive Species Council meeting together in Corbett.
Mr. Chair? Yes. Thank you. The question I had, first I was like, what is the difference between, I should know this, a noxious weed and an invasive species? That's my first question. So how is that defined differently? I can look it up in statute. The other is, do we need to have two separate boards, or could, I mean, the fact that you're serving on these two boards, is there any way to triage and have one as a subset to the other, since they seem to be connected as far as coordination, agency time, staff time? I'm just throwing this out as a question to see, you know, not having been intimately involved with both, but sort of wondering, you know, is there any way we can triage, since one seems like sort of a subset of the other? But
Chair Roblin, Representative Dingfelder. Noxious weeds are invasive species. So invasive species encompasses animals and plants, vertebrates, invertebrates, you name it. That's the big umbrella. And a piece of that is terrestrial plants, noxious weeds.
That's a subset.
Yeah. As far as your second question there about is there a way to make them work better together or make one a subset of the other, they were both created in statute. I guess you folks have the power to change that if you want to.
Well, and I, if I may,
yes.
Mr. Chair, and I sit on the Ways and Means Subcommittee, and one of the questions I'm going to ask is how much does this cost us to run two separate, you know, a council and a weed board, and is there any way to have one as a subset and maybe share staff? I mean, that's a question I'll probably wait and ask in Ways and Means, but I'd like to see what is, they're both run out of the Department of Agriculture, is that correct?
Chair Roblin, Representative Dingfelder, that is correct, and they're staffed by the same people anyway. There isn't, the Invasive Species Council does not have a staff. It's made up of the members. The Weed Board, I serve as a member of that board, and Tim Butler, the Noxious Weed Program Chair, is the department program person who makes the Weed Board run. He provides the support, and he also has a clerical person that works with him, Joe Davis. So already, it's the same people doing the support.
There's not a whole
support.
One set over here.
No.
Okay.
And my question would be, if you're on the Invasive Species Board and an invasive species is heading our way, it's not a plant, so now we have zebra mussel. You know, a cousin of it is now in Lake Mead, so it's getting close. And so are there grants like you have, or other things to do eradication? How do we go about, you have 66 funds for the Weed Board to send out grants to eradicate particular things and help people do it. Is there a similar avenue for people in invasive species other than a plant?
Chair Roblin, when the Invasive Species Council was envisioned, it was set up to have a pot of money for exactly what you're talking about. That was never funded, so the pot remains there and it's empty, and if you'd like to put some funds in it, I'm sure it would be appreciated.
That's Jackie. She's
yeah. Actually, I have a follow-up question to your question.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are federal funds available through the Federal Farm Bill or specifically for invasive species? You know, that would seem a logical thing, given especially with the reauthorization of the Farm Bill in front of us.
Yeah, Chair Roland, Representative Dingfelder. A lot of the programs that deal with invasive species have been ongoing for a long time. The invasive species is kind of a new catchword, but gypsy moth program, the Japanese beetle program that the department has run for a long time are federally funded and have been for many, many years. As far as new money, there's been a lot of talk about new money for invasive species, especially in the USDA pest detection line item and in their emerging pest line item. And up till now, it's been talk without any increases.
Is there an annual report by either the Weed Board or the Invasive Species Board that it lists the kinds of things that are currently here or we're worried about?
Chair Roblin, yes. This is the report card that comes out annually from the Invasive Species Council. It assesses a grade, but it also lists all the 100 worst species that we're trying to keep out, and those are the ones that the Progress Board grades us on. Mm-hmm. Also, one of the Department's of Agriculture's performance measures is related to this list. It also, at the back, the chronology of things that happened during the year related to invasive species in Oregon. So there's, you know, a list of 45 incidents related to invasive species from last year. And yes, that's we've had a report card ever since the Invasive Species Council first came out. The State Weed Board doesn't issue an annual report in the same way, but we have all kinds of statistics. If you'd like, I can get some on numbers of grants or amount of money spent or whatever. I'd be happy to do that.
I mean, and Brian's not here, had an emergency, but one of his was Scotch Broom, and he was wondering, how much money do we spend annually on trying to get rid of Scotch Broom? So that kind of information would be available?
Chair Roldan, I can answer that one.
Oh. A lot.
There was an assessment, economic assessment done by Oregon State University about two biennia ago when the legislature directed us to do a strategic plan, and that economic assessment was done at the same time. And Scotch broom is the weed in the state that the most money is spent on, and it's phenomenal. I don't know, $40 million a year or something, and that's not the department. That's everybody working on Scotch broom. A lot of that's in reforestation control. So, you know, you want to plant something, you've got to keep the Scotch broom down, or it's just going to get shaded out. The department actually spends relatively little on Scotch broom, and the only money that we spend on Scotch broom is related to biological control. And there's a seed weevil and a seed beetle. And after Representative Clem's question, I went back and asked the weed control experts in the department, you know, how good are they? What are they doing out there? Is it making a difference? And the answer is that if you look at the viability of seed, they're taking out 80 to 90% of the seed that's produced in the state, but that leaves 10 or 20%, and it doesn't kill any of the existing plants. And 10 or 20% is plenty to replenish the Scotch broom that's out there and to allow it to continue to spread. So it would be a whole lot worse if those beetles weren't out there, but it's still a huge problem.
Okay, and I guess my last question, butterfly plant is tearing up roads, and we're having problems maybe with the reauthorization of the county payments plan, which is a lot goes to roads. And it gets out there, and it's amazing. Sidewalks, this little plant, and I know we've done some things with it, but it was one of those, again, that came in as a plant, and people like it. I think there's even one in my backyard.
You can order it.
Oh, you still can't order it?
Sure.
So I guess that's one of the ones that just is intriguing to me, so I'll ask that question, I guess, about butterfly plants.
Sure. Representative Roblin, that's a good example of a weed that went through that whole process that I listed. It was on the watch list. We did a risk assessment. We did a presentation to the weed board. We took the weed board down and showed them some of the what's going on in your part of the state.
It sure is.
Where the butterfly bush now far away from residential areas, which nobody had really seen that until 5 years ago, 6 years ago, not very long. And so it has been added to the list. And we have some more work to do there because we added it in the same way that we did English ivy, where we said the wild type butterfly bush is prohibited. You can't grow that, sell it anymore. But there's many, many varieties with red flowers and purple flowers and white flowers and yellow flowers, and we left those on. You can still buy those. You can order them, and you don't see those in the wild the way you do that the normal wild type. However, James Altland at the experiment station in Aurora with OSU has been doing some genetic work and just variety trials, and it turns out they'll all interbreed, and so that you can buy a purple flowered variety or a white flowered variety or something, it can cross with a wild type, and you can get more wild type. The wild type genetics are favorable, and you can just get more and more. So that is an issue that needs to come back to the weed board for tweaking, and I'm not sure how they'll do that, but we've got some more work to do on butterfly bush.
The other one in our area has been the European beechgrass, which has been pretty remarkable. In my short, 32 years here, how it has stabilized the dunes is pretty remarkable.
Yes. you know, that one was brought in and planted. And
yeah, I know.
We have made some mistakes like that in the past.
Any other questions? Clara, yes.
I have one. I just was curious what the outreach might be, public education, to let consumers know that they shouldn't be buying those, because I have many people in the Corbett area who love Scotch broom. They think the yellow flowers are great. And you go, oh my gosh, you know, we spend all this money to eradicate those. And the National Scenic Area, you can drive up to Hood River and just see them all over the sides of the road. So yeah. I just wonder what we do.
Yeah, Chair Roblin, Representative Smith, I think outreach and education is one of the areas that we don't do very well at. We just, resources are a big issue, and we tend to focus on actually doing work on the ground and projects, and we're not particularly good at that piece of the puzzle. The Invasive Species Council, that is one of their four goals and purposes that the legislature gave them, is to work on that outreach and education piece, because that's really where there's hope. I mean, if people understand the importance of invasive species, they'll do the right thing. But you have to educate them, and a lot of people right now don't know what you're talking about when you say invasive species. Is that an immigration issue? What's going on here? So we do have a lot of work to do in that area. I think it's gaining some traction. I'd like to think that there's more articles in the newspaper. Certainly the report card that the Invasive Species Council puts out generates a blip of interest every year, and we get a bunch of calls and media coverage at that point. But there's definitely a lot more work that needs to be done.
And I guess I'll say my last comment on the Scotch broom one is that I am very concerned personally about the Biscuit Fire area and Scotch broom and the ability for the natural species to grow through that over the next 20 years. So it's going to be an interesting deal, because we have done so well. Our climate is so perfect for Scotch broom, it appears, and our soils. It just, those kinds of burns make me very nervous with regard to these invasive species.
So. Chair, you're absolutely right. And here's something else that if you're scared of Scotch broom, there's a worse one on out there called Portuguese broom. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, is anyone from Douglas County or Linn County?
I have some Douglas County. the Reedsport area. Yeah.
Portuguese broom is like Scotch broom on steroids. And it literally can grow 20 feet tall and 20 feet wide, one bush. And so our climate is really favorable for Scotch broom. It's extremely favorable for Portuguese broom. And that's one that we have on our A list to try to just not let that one get away the way Scotch broom has. Because it would shade out the Scotch broom. It would be much worse.
Jeez, cheering thought.
Yeah. Well, hopefully this is helpful to get the message out that we have a problem with some of these visiting plants. Any other questions? Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
And we'll close that hearing, informational hearing. Do you want to do this one?
Sure.
Just,
okay.
Here's the other one. I'll open the meeting in a second. See if he wants to do one. Would you like to do one?
It's the script for the movie.
That one. Yeah, I think that's okay. Or
20. You want?
Yeah, we'll go with.
We'll do yours first.
Yeah, we'll do 67 first.
Okay.
I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2067. Any discussion? This is, I'll let you
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2067 is a bill that you heard last week that would extend the current system of fire cost allocation in the state. There have been, to my knowledge, no amendments proposed, and you should have in front of you the updated staff measures.
Is there a fiscal impact?
You know, this bill does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, so we do not have a fiscal right now.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2067 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Actually, it's the Ways and Means, not to the floor, right?
Yes, it is to Ways and Means. And the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
I have a motion to refer. I move to Representative Smith.
Yes.
Moves House Bill 2067 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and has the bill referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, and I could have said that a little differently.
That's
so it is a referral by prior to Joint Ways and Means. So we are taking action to refer this to Ways and Means.
Yes.
Any discussion? Shall we go through our roll call?
Sure.
Representative
Boquist. Excused.
Representative Flynn.
Excused.
Representative Dingfeld.
Aye.
Representative McPherson.
Aye.
Representative
Mount.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
She
had a no.
Aye.
Chair Rowland.
Aye. Motion has passed. Received the required majority and passed. So we'll send it off to our Ways and Means friends.
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, I better. So we'll close that hearing on her work session, and I will open a work session on 2068. Do I have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2068 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Having Mr. Maurer has made a motion to pass 2068 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Well, let's hear a little bit about the bill, which I should have done first.
That's okay. House Bill 2068 is the bill that would add the state forest group to the invasive species council. There is no fiscal impact for this bill.
Okay. Any further discussion with regard to 2068? Okay, seeing that, we'll do another roll call vote on 2068.
Representative
Gophers? Excused.
Representative
Clinton? Aye. Representative Dingfeld?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Chair Rowland?
Aye.
The motion...
Sign a carrier?
Oh, that's right. We do have to sign a carrier. I can do this first, though. Motion is received. It's... Constitutional.
Chair,
required majority.
One of the new members carry a bill.
Yeah,
that's true.
We have two.
We have two. Sure. And we have two. Well, we only have one bill to get to carry. Is there anybody that would really love to carry this bill?
Well, I think this is a good experience for our new members.
Yeah, I think this would be a good one for freshmen. Vice chair first.
Yeah, so.
Oh, God.
So, Representative Clem, are you willing to carry this bill?
Certainly, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Come late, that's...
What did you get?
Darn veterinary appointment.
And we can entertain, if there's no objections, the opportunity for Mr. Clem to vote on, Representative Clem to vote on the prior bill. Is there any objection to allowing Representative Clem to vote?
Do you need fire protection?
Oh, so I need a motion for that.
Open up that.
Oh,
you
so
can
need
either close it or you can close it. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Close the hearing on or the... On 26, the work session on 2068, and we'll open. Would it be a work session?
Yeah.
Reopen
yeah.
Work session on 2067. So, Representative Clem, how would you vote?
Aye.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
We will close that work session on 2067. Any other business before the committee? Any questions or concerns? Anything from the people here assembled? Okay. Then we will close this meeting of the House Agriculture and Natural Resource Committee. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Not a problem.
Sorry, I made everybody listen to everything else.
We'll get it.
Thank you.
You're
all right, we got it. Trying to deal with the senior citizen dog and the vet and acupuncture and a lot of stuff. So.
And where are we meeting?
Senior citizen dog?
By 11.
My dog's 12 and a half. Oh, I love her dearly. I just worry. It's
not easy. I've had him since he was 8 weeks old. He goes everywhere with me. Orchard, computers, wherever. He's in my office. He's a Weimer owner.
In fact, we might want to change everybody else. This is just the letter that I got.
We almost lost him last weekend, and we're trying to avoid
Measure 37.
It,